And the last case on the court's oral argument calendar this morning is in the matter of the welfare of the children of M.H. And we are ready to hear arguments from counsel for appellant. It's my understanding that there is going to be a sharing of time between counsel for respondent. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So in one attorney is going to take the 15 minutes. Or what's the split? I'm sorry.
Your Honor, I would be handling the principal argument for 15 minutes, and then Ms. Dawson would do the rebuttal.
Okay. You may proceed.
Thank you, and good morning. The court has received our briefs and has seen the procedural posture in this case. I think it's well laid out in the briefs and in the court's findings, so I won't go over that. The petition here regards essentially my client, who is the father, and the mother, who is Ms. Dawson's client, and also two young children, B.H. and N.H. And the issue is basically whether the district court abused its discretion in concluding that termination of parental rights was in the best interest of the children, and also whether the court erred in denying a transfer of legal and physical custody to the mother, N.H. And our argument in a nutshell is that termination is not appropriate in this case, but that if somehow the court believed that was the case, that a transfer would certainly be a much better option than complete termination. As the court is aware, the parental rights should only be terminated only for grave and weighty reasons. The children's best interests are always paramount in a case like this.
Can I focus on that last point? The children's best interest. This is the first case I think I've seen where the parties have stipulated that 260C.301 subdivision 1B6 applies, that there's clear and convincing evidence of it, and then later arguing that termination is not in the best interests of the child. And the reason it's confusing to me, and I'm wondering whether there's a case on the point, because here, under that provision, unlike the other provisions for termination, termination is appropriate where, let's see, I can get right from the statute here, where there's been this egregious harm of such a duration or chronicity that indicates a lack of regard for the child's well-being, such that a reasonable person would believe that it's contrary to the best interests of the child or of any child to be in the parent's care. So in this case, your client and frankly, mother stipulated that no reasonable person would think that it's in the best interest of the child to be in your client's care. And now you're arguing that the district court made an erroneous best interest finding. I'm wondering why it is that your client is not stopped from making that argument, having stipulated to this particular statutory basis for termination.
Your Honor, excellent question. I've wrestled with that too. And I think that the answer to that comes, and I'm looking at the two cases I have here to give you a cite, but there can be the statutory basis for the egregious harm here, and it does entail what the court just noted, but still there can be a finding that it's not in the best interest of the children to terminate, because the best interest still is the primary or main focus, even if a statutory basis is found.
Right, so, but the statutory basis in this case includes that no reasonable person would believe it's in the best interest of the child. And I'm just wondering whether there was, in any of the cases you found, where the parties actually stipulated that this statute applies, including the best interest determination within the statutory provision, and then later said, well, basically, even though no reasonable person would say that it's in the best interest of the child to maintain the parental relationship, it's somehow not in the best not in the best interest of the child to terminate. I don't see how those two are logically plausible.
Your Honor, I think that the idea of getting to that egregious harm aspect of it, to stipulate to that so that there aren't efforts to rehabilitate and those sorts of things, I think that that standard is there so that that can be met, but that still the court down the road, and I'll say the district court and its findings and the court here, can still look at the overall best interests of the child and make a determination on the whole as to whether it's in the best interest to terminate or not. So I think that's more directed just towards that first part. Is there a statutory basis? There is. And that statutory basis has that, I'll say, concerning language, but I don't think that it obviates the overall analysis that says we still have to look at the best interest, that is paramount.
Right. So, but if it's paramount and wedded into the statute already, take me through as a matter of logic how it is we would say that the statute applies, that the statute's met, and that it includes this best interest element, and that nevertheless, the district court abused its discretion by determining that best interests are not in favor of termination. How would we, as a matter of logic or statutory construction, do that?
I'd say as a matter of logic, right out of the chute, if the idea was that there's a stipulation or finding that there's the statutory element, and if it's that statutory element that has that language that the court is concerned about, then the legislature should have in there that just per se, there's going to be a termination because it couldn't ever be overcome, and that there could be no other concern that would be more paramount to that. The legislature could have written that in, and they didn't. It's just one of those, it's just the statutory basis to go out and terminate. And I'd also state that in the cases that are out there, or some cases that are out there, and we cite a number of cases in our brief, among them this MDO and JBO. One of the cases is a murder of the parent murdered another child and ended up in a similar sort of situation. Another one is one of the children that was being dealt with in terms of whether there should be termination. She had been sexually assaulted for over 7 years.
Let's talk about those cases. MDO, I mean, MDO is pretty clear. The district court in that case made factual determinations that would support termination of parental rights, and or that would oppose termination. And this court, according to the Supreme Court, in a divided court, Judge Klopaki dissenting, made findings that were contrary to the district court's findings. And the Supreme Court took this court to task, saying you can't undo what the district court did based upon your own fact finding. In other words, this court is to give deference to the district court on the very factors that you're asking us not to give deference to the district court in. I don't see how MDO supports your position. Do you agree that the procedural setting of that case makes it functionally dissimilar to this case?
I think there's dissimilarities, Your Honor, but I also think that the trial court there found that it was in the best interest of the children that they would be served by maintaining and strengthening the relationship, not terminating it, even in a situation where the mother had been convicted of second-degree murder. So I think that that's obviously supportive of a situation here where my client, the father, wasn't convicted of second-degree murder. He pled guilty and took responsibility for a manslaughter charge. So I see where the court is going with this, but the reality is the standard of review here is whether the trial court's findings addresses.
MDO seems quite different in another significant respect, which was that her incarceration was in 1987, and the termination proceedings took place long after that, where there's the opportunity for change. Here we've got an immediate circumstance where dad kills a child and immediately the next children are taken out of the parents' care And there isn't a, we're not talking about after a period of potential rehabilitation. This is immediate as it gets, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong about that, and explain if I am right why it doesn't make that case not just procedurally dissimilar, but factually dissimilar.
I'm not really sure what the court is getting at. I'm sorry, I just didn't understand what.
Well, okay, I'm getting at this. In that case, you by the time you got to the termination, where the district court says that essentially that there's not a basis to terminate, the court was then looking at someone who had committed a crime long before the termination proceeding. And here we've got an immediate termination. And I correct me if I'm wrong too. I'm not sure if that statutory basis existed at the time, the one that's being relied upon here. I could be wrong about that. I know the statute has changed.
I think the statutory basis did exist back then, Your Honor. I believe that it did, and it was a separate, you know, sort of situation over there. I guess what I would say is that, you know, looking at the standard of review here and what the court is to look at on this thing is, it's these specific facts here. I mean, I think the essence of MDO is that you could have a mother that was convicted of second degree murder, and yet the court still came back and said maintaining and strengthening a relationship and not terminating it is in the children's best interest. And here in our case, we've got a situation with two young children, a man who went out and took responsibility, admitted that what he did is wrong, is going to be out in prison until 2025. There's a little bit of a discrepancy as to whether a relationship was formed or not with the one child that was alive at the time, which then calls into question whether there was clear and convincing evidence at all that there wasn't any sort of a relationship. This is the sort of situation where I think
correct me if I'm wrong, but there was testimony that there was not a significant relationship. I mean, you have some online communication. I thought there was testimony that the district court found credible, which is that you don't create a bond without a physical relationship.
Yeah, and we would ask the court to find that that is just that's not reasonable, and that's clearly erroneous. Think of the situations with a person in the military that goes off on a deployment, and the baby just got born, and they're gone for a year or two, and they talk and they do their things over audio and video and that sort of thing. Of course, a bond can be created down the road between a child and a father under those circumstances. I think that
I thought the question was whether there was a bond that was already established. I thought that was the issue the district court was resolving.
I think it's what we'd ask the court to be looking at is there a bond? And I think there was a bond. Discrepancies in the evidence. The father and the mother both testified that it appeared that a bond was there. The little boy would show his toys to the father. There was a reference that he sometimes would hug the iPad when it was there. My client, the father, felt that there was a bond developing, you know, to the extent that you could get one. Witnesses from the state came in and essentially talked to the idea that you couldn't possibly do that. And again, I think erroneously stated and the court erroneously bought into the idea that somehow you couldn't have a bond and that you couldn't form something through virtual ways of communication. I think the mother's brief talks about that and states it well. The reality is, and this is a question that the court has to deal with is it just, oh, there wasn't a bond enough that was formed, therefore we'll just terminate this and move forward on that being one of the grounds, or should there be an ability for a person who has gone out under my client's circumstances and admitted his guilt and moves forward, can't he work on and ultimately establish a basis? And I would submit to the court that it's obvious and known to everybody that there's some bond between a child and the father, and that can be developed, and that's there's never going to be anybody else that's going to be the father except for this father. And to go along with this decision here, based on what has been found, completely wipes that out. These children will never have a chance to go out and be able to put in their two cents worth about what they want. It completely gets rid of it. That's not the way that this should work. The court can allow there to be a relationship that builds. There can be protective factors in place. There can be a relationship. And I would just state, and I didn't get to this really, but in looking at the court's the balancing test and the way that they look at that, the court's whole order is 19 pages long. And the balancing test in its analysis on this thing is basically taken care of in 16 sentences. The court dispenses with the balancing test on whether or not we should do termination or not in about 10 sentences. And then when it turns to the should we go out and transfer custody, which is an excellent alternative if the court doesn't believe in the termination, it dispenses with that in 6 sentences. And I think that a weighty decision like this entails more analysis. And I don't think, and I don't have time now to go through it, I don't think that the court's analysis and ultimate findings were appropriate and conclusions were appropriate. So we would respectfully ask that the court not allow termination to take place. It is not the right decision to take these children away from their father for the rest of their lives up until they turn of age. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Before we start with arguments from respondents, I think I need to clarify something, and this was the source of my confusion when we talked about a sharing of time. So mother is a respondent in this appeal. She's an appellant?
She's an appellant.
All right. That's my confusion, because she's listed as a respondent on my calendar, and I was wondering how then she would be taking rebuttal argument. I was going to come up with a clever way to do that, but I will correct the calendar to indicate that she is an appellant. Thank you. Then we will hear from attorney for the county, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Would you please introduce yourself and begin your argument?
Yes, thank you. My name is Erin Johnson, Assistant Washington County Attorney, and I am representing Respondent Washington County Community Services today. Today, the county is requesting that this court affirm the district court's decision in all aspects. And much discussion has occurred about what's the best interest in this case, what are the best interests of these children, and that a termination of parental rights is something that should only occur for grave and weighty reasons. That's a common citation from case law that we see in termination of parental rights cases. And I would note that in this particular case, we have what I would consider to be about the gravest and weightiest reason that could be before a court to terminate parental rights.
Can you address the legal concern that I raised with father's counsel? I don't see it argued in your brief. I've not seen a case where parties have stipulated to subdivision 1B6 as the basis for termination, that one of the elements of which would be that a reasonable person would believe it's contrary to the best interest of the child or any child to be in the parent's care, and then argue that it is in the best interest of the child to be in that parent's care. I don't think that legal concern is raised in your brief. I'm wondering whether that's something that you're just conceding. Are you aware of any case law that addresses the issue?
Your Honor, I am not. What I can say is that it's a very well-established tenant and child protection law that there needs to be both a statutory basis and a best interest finding. So although that egregious harm statute does reference that language, and what I think that goes to on some level is that egregious harm falls under one of the categories that the child protection law allows to be what's called an expedited or bypass termination of parental rights petition. It's in that level of circumstances that the legislature determined did not need to go necessarily through the more usual route of filing.
I understand that. But as a matter of substance, the statute includes the same substance that's considered in the best interest analysis. And if it's conceded by the parties that it is not in the best interest of the parent, of any child, to be in this parent's care, I don't understand. I mean, I understand there's a two-part analysis that you have these other findings, but in this case, in this statute, it seems to be embedded. And I don't understand logically how it is that we could possibly reverse the district court's best interest finding after it is conceded by all of the parties that the best interest of the child and any child would be not to be in father's care.
Certainly, I think that Your Honor's point is well taken, and I agree that it is embedded in there. And certainly, you know, the county's position is that the district court's decision shouldn't be overturned. I think if you wanted to delve into it a little more, because it does reference best interests, the court then still has to flesh out, if you will, what those best interests are. And in this case, unlike many cases that we see at the Court of Appeals, the district court did specifically address those best interest findings. This isn't a situation where there was really no explanation or no rationale for why the court found it was in best interest. In fact, the district court actually did, I believe, not 16 lines as was indicated, but 3 to 4 pages regarding the best interest determination. So even though I agree with Your Honor that it is embedded in there, and logically, it seems like if it's stipulated to, it maybe that ends the argument. I think there still is a requirement to really pull out that best interest piece and expand more upon that. So I guess that is how I would view this particular situation. I think it's also important to note that, as Your Honor did note before, as it related to the MDO case, that the role of the appellate court is not to necessarily substitute their thoughts or findings for that of the district court. And that was the issue in the MDO case, which I believe does distinguish it from this case here. And this court is to give a lot of deference to the district court's findings. And just because the district court or another court could have come to a different conclusion with the record that was put before it does not make the district court's decision clearly erroneous. And in this case, the district court considered a number of factors when it looked at what was in the children's best interest. It considered the nature of the crime. It considered the relationship, or as the district court concluded, the lack thereof of a relationship between the father and the children. Considered the children's need for safety and stability. It considered what the father had done both prior to his incarceration, prior to being charged with the crime, and then following his plea to the crime and his subsequent sentencing. The court considered the ability of the mother to keep the children safe. All of these things were considered by the court. There was testimony about all of these issues. The court made findings about that, and the district court also made specific credibility findings and specific findings about which testimony and which items the district court was going to give weight to. So none of those things.
Could the district court have safeguarded the children by restricting mother from allowing in a transfer? Assume the district court said we're going to transfer, but not terminate. Why couldn't the district court have entered an order that would have effectively protected the children by prohibiting mother from allowing children to have physical contact with father, especially in light of the fact that he's going to be incarcerated for a considerable period?
I think that certainly the district court could have entered that, but the issue is whether that would be in the best interest of these particular children in this particular circumstance, and the district court found that it wouldn't be. And one of the discussions that occurred during testimony was about the nature of a transfer of custody and what that looks like, and the ability to continually have modifications, to continually come back, make changes, and the position that puts these children in throughout the rest of their life, to really not have any sort of certainty about what that relationship could be, what it might look like. And to be quite frank, the potential pressure that puts on the children to have to be in a position down the road to address what happened, what their father did, how that has impacted them, how that impacts their family. All of those things, while there could be an order put in place that could prohibit contact, doesn't necessarily go to stability and permanency for a child.
I'm not sure I understand. If the primary issue is protecting the children's physical safety, why can't these other psychological issues that you're referring to, which have not surfaced yet, be addressed in the future if and when they occur?
I would say that physical safety is certainly a large aspect of it, but emotional well-being, emotional safety is also something that we look out for in children.
Counsel, Judge Larkin, and I'm sorry for my confusion earlier about who's who in this case, but am I correct? There was no child protection proceeding against mother. Her rights are not affected.
That's correct. This was solely brought against father.
So what stops mother in the future from allowing contact between father and the kids?
Your Honor, well, technically nothing. She has been informed of the ramifications of that from the standpoint of how that would potentially look in terms of whether she is making safe decisions for her children. And I think one of the things that was noted by the social worker during her work with the mother, and I believe there is testimony to this in the record, was that the mother did seem to follow through with specific requirements, with black and white, if you will, orders or requirements. And so one of the things that was discussed is that a termination of parental rights is a very black and white thing. And it makes it very clear what the expectation is going forward. And that would be that there is no contact, there is no parent-child relationship.
So is there such a thing as at the time of dad's release in 2025 or before, if he's being released and he's going to move back home with mother where the two boys are, I mean, can't the county file a CHIPS petition then and
yes.
then proceed to a termination? And then
we could.
And my next question is this. If his parental, this is kind of getting out there a bit, but if his parental rights are terminated and he's out and the children are all together, is there a prohibition against him adopting the children? And then he'd be their father again. I mean, the thing is, we got kids that are going to be 6 and 4, I think, when he's out. And I mean, this is a bigger geographical area. But I used to struggle with these things in my area because, you know, the parents, they live down the street. And even though you sever that tie, I don't know that it's necessarily a good thing.
To answer one of your first questions, Judge, I think the fact that he has been convicted of a crime that would constitute egregious harm under the child protection statutes, as well, if the court affirms the termination order, would have an involuntary termination of parental rights. Both of those things would exclude him from being eligible for adoption. But I understand what the court is saying in that, you know, on some level, I will agree. These things are pieces of paper. And what does that mean when you're looking at relationships? However,
the awkward part for me reading between the lines, we've had cases where termination of one parent has resulted from failure to protect from the other parent by allowing access when the parent engaging in the clear misconduct is the one that was really the focus. But nevertheless, the fallout was the other parent. In a case like this, I'll tell you what concerns me is between the lines. It almost, and you don't have to answer this, of course, it feels like what's going on in the district court is we're not, and by the county, is we're not going to seek to terminate mother's parental rights because we're going to wait and give her an opportunity to sever ties with father while he's in prison. And I mean, I'm guessing, as Judge Warkey and Judge Larkin's question suggests, that there's going to be an awkward moment down the line when father is about to be released and the county is going to have to decide what are we going to do with mother's relationship with the child after a period of time where mother has developed a significant bond with the child. Obviously, that's not our case, but, you know, it feels like a train wreck is coming.
I can, without commenting specifically on why the county made its decision, I can just say that those are all discussions the county has had.
And I don't know if this has been discussed, but isn't there a law that requires the county to move for termination in these circumstances?
Yes.
Okay. Is there a way you can be relieved of that obligation? I mean, it's presumed there's going to be a termination action, and indeed there must be unless you convince the court otherwise. Is that what the law says?
This would fall into yes, that it's a requirement that an immediate termination of parental rights petition is filed unless the county finds that compelling reasons exist to file a child protection, a CHIPS petition, if you will, child needed protection or services. In this particular case, because of the circumstances, again, when we have the death of an infant child caused by a parent, the county did not believe that there were any compelling circumstances that would warrant making that request. And so we did follow the law and filed that termination of parental rights petition.
Okay, so some of this is out of your hands at this point.
If I'm following the law, then yes.
Which we hope you do.
I hope that as well. With this, my remaining time, I have just asked the court again to affirm the district court's decision. I would note that all of the court's findings are supported by the record, whether that's through testimony of witnesses or through evidence that was submitted to the court. And that the fact that another court might have found a different determination does not make this district court's findings clearly erroneous. Thank you.
All right, counsel for mother, would you introduce yourself for the record and begin your argument, please?
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lucas Dawson, and I am the attorney for the appellant NH. If I could just jump right in at the question that Judge Ross has been asking, I've kind of been sitting here chomping at the bit. As far as that, I think my initial response to the question of how to handle the statutory basis, I would just draw the court's attention to the stipulation regarding that agreement, and specifically paragraph 6, where the parties agreed and the court approved that having concluded a statutory basis exists, the remaining issue is whether termination is in the best interest of the children. So this was an agreement that was reached by all parties and was approved to the court. As to whether there's
But isn't that agreement inconsistent with the statute? I mean, the statute says essentially best interest of the child is no reasonable person would think it's best interest of the child to maintain the relationship. But then you stipulate to the fact that what's left to argue is best interest of the child. Right. I don't know how that works logically.
Well, and I think I just point the court to there is quite a bit of lengthy case law history. Just I'm going to start right off with the statute 260C.301 subdivision 7 tells us that the best interest is the paramount consideration for the court. So that has to be the number one consideration over all else.
I agree. That's my point.
Yep. Secondary, though, I'd point the court to, I mean, the wealth of case law, whether it's In re the Welfare of RW, that was a Minnesota 2004 case. DLD, and I apologize, I don't have the year in front of me. I'd also point the court to the JBO case, which I understand was unpublished, but just I think it goes a little bit deeper to your specific question, where that case, the court did note that the statutory basis was not challenged. So it appears that the parents accepted that that statutory basis existed, yet this court still reversed on the best interest analysis.
Well, it's different. Not challenging it and stipulating to it are different. When mother says, hey, we agree, dad, you know, no reasonable person would put this kid with any child because it's not in the best interest of any child. That seems to be different from just not challenging the statutory basis.
Right. But I think to even look further at the statute, and if we apply it specifically to the facts of this case, What's still, I think, secondary to the question that you're asking is the part of the statute which talks about in the parent's care. Here, mother was very clear, and I don't think it can be ignored. She filed a petition to transfer custody. She's not actually saying that either one of these children should be in father's care. She is saying it is still in their best interest, even when you do all of this analysis, that she be granted sole custody. And she was very clear in her testimony that she's not saying father is released and suddenly they're going to be one.
But wait, but she is challenging the termination of father's parental rights, correct?
Correct. She is challenging. However, when you look at the permanency options that are available, the two main options that are available to the district court is the termination of parental rights or a transfer of custody. Here, the end goal was not adoption. And so when you look at what the statute is also contemplating, that is when your end goal is not adoption, the transfer of custody is a perfectly reasonable alternative. And especially when we look at, and just the site for that one is 260.012 subdivision.
Help me to understand the procedure here. So district court makes it really clear, mom's parental rights are not being terminated. So mom's interest in transfer is what? From whom to whom would the transfer occur?
Mom's interest in the transfer is that she is the sole custodian. She is the sole provider for these children. But by doing that, she is allowed to make decisions for these children to avoid the train wreck that, quite frankly, I think was a concern on her behalf. That, and there were questions at this level at the district court about what happens if these children get older and are struggling emotionally and mentally, and some sort of contact with father would actually be helpful to them emotionally. And the response was, well, then they need to have therapy that they're not going to have that contact. It's just ignoring what could be the need for these children and being able to actually meet their needs. Her request was to be able to meet their needs. Yes, Judge Lemon.
Counsel, the benefit of the TPR, as I see it, is mom's still in a position to make those decisions and meet their needs. But there is no risk of father going to court and asking for some other relief if mom and he disagree about what's in the best interest of the children. I mean, she ends up with all the decision-making power, and dad has no ability to take her to court and say, nope, I want visitation, I want to change custody. So, I mean, what's the only downside I see is if father comes into some sort of financial means and the kids could not inherit from him. But I mean, what's the downside so long as mom is left in the position of power and control over decisions related to the children's upbringing and best interests?
I mean, I think it's more than just father comes into means, and I realize I'm out of time if I can finish, that it's more than the means. It's father's the requirement to pay child support. It's the ability to meet the children's needs. And I think one of the questions raised at the district court was permanency, that somehow the TPR gives more permanency, except that the legislature has mandated that a transfer of custody is a perfectly acceptable alternative form of permanency. And when we look at that, there were no safety concerns at the time of trial, that mother was meeting all of the children's needs, that she had kept them safe, that she had done everything she needed to do, she's the one that's going to be raising the children.
Permanency also takes into account ongoing litigation. And I mean, if the father's rights are terminated, he really doesn't have a leg to stand on to come into court and ask for visitation or custody.
And so, I think
in that sense, it is the termination is more permanent in the sense that it forecloses litigation about any changes in the future.
I think it forecloses, does it technically foreclose that litigation? Yes. However, just because father may be able to come back to court does not mean father will be successful. It also forecloses any needs that the children may develop that can be better addressed through a transfer versus a termination, where the county was very clear, based on their testimony, that it is a no contact, that there is no permission. And then mom's looking at this possibility of, well, what happens that we don't know, versus at least having sort of that fallback and that safety net.
Well, and I mean, the answer to that is we don't know. And, you know, when the kids get older and they want to see their dad and they're asking to do so. And mom makes a decision that it's okay. And there are safe ways to accomplish that. It's not a slam dunk for the county at that point to come in. I mean, they would have to convince the court that that is the best thing for the kids based on those circumstances at that time. I don't think anybody here can presume that if mom allows contact with dad at some point in the future, she automatically loses her rights to her kids. I think the county, if that's their belief, and I see the county attorney shaking her head, that's not their belief. So this does put mom in the strongest position legally, I think.
Well, I guess as somebody who represents parents and child protection and who has represented children, if they're coming back in, that in and of itself is traumatic for children and for families. And so to me, I guess we're trading how many traumas for the other. And I think the concern is just there's so many unknowns that a per se rule and a one size fits all versus what I believe mom's opinion and belief and argument was that the transfer allows for that flexibility and it's not a one size fits all.
Understood. Are there any other questions from the panel members? No. Okay. Well, that concludes the oral argument in